Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm very excited to be with you this morning. Nervous and excited. And I think we've just been blessed with some amazing speakers over the last few days. And as Rolf said, I was very glad to be part of it, as missions is very, very dear to my heart and the various things we can do. I was thinking all week, what can I do to reaffirm that Germans are very cool and that they're nice and that they exercise great leadership skills. So, but then I thought, I really like Scott, you know, so that's a problem. But I'll just give you one of my favorite ones. What do you call a person who can speak three languages? Trilingual. What do you call a person who can speak two languages? Bilingual. And what do you call a person who can just speak one language? An American! Anyway, so if you can give me something on Europe and young people and missions, this is the combination of it all, which just absolutely excites me, gets me on my knees, it burdens me. And so I'm just happy to have some time with you this morning to share about some of the stuff I've learned. So it's more about what we have experienced also in MissionNet, some of the things we see in society today in Europe, and some of the discipleship elements which I found very useful. And they call me the Korean, because I copy and paste a lot. I watch, I go and observe amazing youth ministries across Europe, and then I just see how can I adapt that to my own context and how does it, you know, work and readapt it to mine. So I'm happy to share all I've learned today, and it's due to other amazing people who have invested into me and into my life. Right. I want to talk a bit about who is this young generation, and also then what are some of the tools we have found out, how we can use that, and I also like to hear back from you on this. And then later I will concentrate much more on the discipleship process as such, as we found it to be very successful across Europe, because too often you know the problem that we have made discipleship into a program and not a process. We have sent people off to YWAM and OM and other places for 6 months, a year. Sometimes they come back and get reintegrated into church. Sometimes they're the superstars, so better than the pastors. Sometimes it's very hard to get them back into the original context and really transform. So I'm very burdened, how can discipleship look like a lifelong process for the young people? What I would like us to do first, actually before I start and give you some of my observations on the generation, so I would like us to just form groups, and I would like you within 5 or 6 minutes share in a group of about four, what have you seen to be effective in your area, how to involve youth in missions? Yeah, before I give you mine, I want to get you the chance to actually hear from each other, because I think this room is full of amazing insights, weaknesses and strength we have learned from the past, learned from our disappointments. So what is some of the things you have seen effective in involving youth in missions? Let me just run a bit through who is this generation of young Christian Europeans. I mean, you know that we talk about all these different generations, and I actually came from America, the classification of what is possible, how do we, you know, shape and try to strategize who is part of which group and what are some of the things. So actually it is it's hard, because in our mission work, sometimes we have the youth, the young ones who have just born around the 2000. So sometimes we classify them as the millennials, and sometimes it's a very big thing, the Gen Y, or actually there's three different terms taken for the same age group at the moment. So it's very confusing by psychologists and so on. So some of us just think, give up on that. But it is fascinating to just see that there's a certain characteristic in that new group which we raise in Europe, and also, of course, then also in the global youth culture. There are fascinating stuff on there. tolerant, resilient, work hard, to have a certain lifestyle, and so on. But there's more to them. Who are the Gen Y guys? So it's Gen Y, aka millennial, or aka generation next. So we use different terms. And actually, there are not many books written on this new generation. But if you know of sources, you know, I'm very subjective and very limited in my knowledge. If you think you've found a great book on stuff, or you think you found a good study on that, I would be so delighted to hear from you. Either just, you know, raise your hand and share, or whatever, because sometimes it's very hard to get even the Christian perspective on stuff. You find something secular or not. So what I find interesting in the young generation we work with, they're well educated. Of course, now that we hit the border then with the unemployment across Europe, and you know that Spain and Greece and Italy have one of the highest unemployment among youth in Europe, nearly 50%. So that does a lot to your personal image and also to the country of actually leaving countries. You know, I mean, like our Polish brothers, some of them are here. You know, you lost nearly like a million to the UK and other nations. And interesting also that they constantly want feedback. They have been risen up, you know, by their parents, and they're completely pampered. There's a lot now, actually, the European Union does on the children's rights. So it's no longer about parents' rights, now it's a lot about children's rights. So that, you know, one of the recent laws we had out in Europe, you know, that a terminal ill 8-year-old person can decide to determine his life. You know, this is the Belgium, which was the first one to start it. So the right of a child. There's a new law in debate, I don't know if you mentioned it last year, but a new law which says that actually a child now can divorce from his parents. You know, that the child says, I don't no longer want to be in that family. I prefer to go into a children's home or find foster parents. It's crazy, absolutely crazy. But they do a lot these days to say, this is the children's right. It's their liberty, it's their freedom. But it makes it much harder for us then to work religiously and educationally. You know, everything is put to the state instead of back to the families. So it's interesting what kind of people we get there, because these are the guys we have in our mission agencies now, and we deal with in our churches, and we are actually amazed or shocked that we can't deal with their constant need of someone walking alongside them and mentoring them and so on. They're also very tech-savvy. They're out there in the global world. They're diverse. And interestingly, they're independent much more than ever before and have a good self-esteem. Actually, they live in various paradoxes, but normally they come and say, I'm here and I'm going to change the world. This is theirs, you know? And you think, like, whoa, I mean, your grandparents tried that too, and your parents, and, but yeah, no, they didn't do a good job. It's me, you know? And they're very ambitious. But then, of course, then we come later to the other side, that they actually feel very insecure in some parts. Of course, then computer and everything is easy for them. Social media, hard to resist. They spend about 20 hours or so a week on social media in general, you know, during the week. Sometimes even three hours, you know, more during the day. So, and I still think we as agencies have not caught up to that dilemma of what's happening on the internet and what are the users we make of. Now I'm just so glad that we launched some amazing apps for refugees or young ones across Europe. But I think, you know, what's happening to our young Europeans? So they don't mind, you know, sharing their knowledge as long as you don't dismiss it. If you come and you immediately say, you know, this is not working, you know, we've tried that before, but this is, you know, we're not interested, then you shut them down, then they just go somewhere else. So they're very sensitive in how you receive them, how you're interested in their process. They're ethnically very diverse today. I have lots of churches I deal with, especially in Hamburg. There's not one monolingual church youth group anymore. The churches, the elders are much harder, but the youth groups, they mix much, much easier with each other and have different nations on there. And of course, the respect to religion changes and race. So there are lots of things happening. So for them, it's very normal that everything is, you know, everything is tolerant, everything is possible for them to work with. It's either ethnicity, it's truth, multiple truth is accepted. It's amazing that you have biblical truth next to each other, or even then next to the secular truth, and they just integrate it all into one big picture. And I just challenge them. I think, you know, this is not right. You know, one cannot be right and one cannot be wrong. And then you just accept both. But for them, in their minds, there's no contradiction. They just live, you know, have this tolerance in them, which doesn't matter at all to them. Independent, of course, also because we are lacking the support of our parents. I mean, all these children we work with in general across Europe, you know, 50% of them have, you know, just a single parent to raise them. I mean, I don't know about your divorce rates in your countries, but in some of our countries, it's horrendous. So they become independent very early because they have to be. And of course, then that's where they cling on to their friends, and they create new family units, either on social media or even just among their friends at school or class or studies. They would love to take on responsibility, but they don't know how to end in responsibility. That is a big paradigm shift we have, and it's a big problem for us. We just shared in our group. We take them somewhere, we give them a task, they do it on the spot, but then back home, they don't. You know, they don't put it into practice. They don't know how to do it. So, and it says, you know, 1/4 comes from a single parent household, 3 in 4 have working mothers. So our whole structure changes rapidly. And of course, then the ambition they have, they like to learn and they're willing to do things differently. What I find very interesting that today, we say, you know, they prefer to ask questions than to waste any time to explore and figure out for themselves. I mean, I actually, you know, I tend to be that much more than ever before. I go onto Google, there's always a YouTube video explaining you or what to do on your computer. You just type in a problem. There's someone else who's dealt with the problem before. And I think I'm going to just not waste my time on figuring it out. But that makes it very hard with that young generation who is so spoiled and someone else has done the thinking for them and the figuring out. So some of the predictions we have for the future church, of course, we have the millennials who will be called post-Christian in their beliefs, thinking, and worldview, which is going to be a big challenge to the church. And also that we see a trend at the moment that churches have to create smaller units. Like we have to create family units within the churches for them to really feel accepted and be part of something where they really feel I belong to that one. And it does not mean first what I believe, but that I first belong. You know, that strong statement by Grace Davey, belonging before believing, is utterly important to them. Well, we make it often very hard. We come with our doctrine first and say, this is what you have to do, and this is how you have to believe, and this is how you have to dress. But for them, it's first being part of something they belong to, and where they feel accepted and loved, no matter what they think and whatever truth is for them. I don't know, I mentioned that last year, but I don't know how much you've heard about the Sticky Faith study. Of course, I mean, I'm sure Americans have done heaps of times, but Kara Powell has done a big study, a research on youth and youth leaving the church. And so one of the things which came out is that, you know, 80% of Americans, at least that's what she found out, maybe you can disagree with that one, Scott, 80% of all young people leave the church by the age of 18. That's in America. And we're looking into predictions for Europe, which is about 60 to 70% of all the young people raised in our churches. And now we think, you know, we already have half, less than ever before, you know, the single parents and so on. So it is very critical. I found a study in the UK which says that if you have two Christian parents who are, you know, Christians, obviously, and so there's a 50% chance of you becoming a Christian. They did a big survey in the UK. If you only have one Christian parent, the chance that you become a Christian are only 25%. So a huge recycling, you know, system is happening here, or actually not, you know, because we're missing the bridge in between. And we can just look on, and I can give you the links to the studies. But I thought, you know, there's, because sometimes we judge, you know, our elders by, you know, how many Christians have, you know, children have they brought to faith, and if they, you know, there's one, the odd one out who has not become a Christian, we judge them very easily. I don't know about your churches, but in our churches we do that very much in Germany. But I look at these statistics and I think, wow, these are horrendous. And I wonder why we are in Europe not more down on our knees and actually fight against that. I'm passionate to see that somehow turn around. And Kara Powell found out, like in the U.S., if you meet a Christian within the first 72 hours at uni, you're going to join the Christian Union or, you know, IFES and so on. But if you don't, you just end up, the first friends you meet on campus are going to be your friends for the future. So, you know, we need to really engage it. Do you get my heart here? I mean, also understand that, you know, that we are really in deep turmoil here. But they also had the study that said that the potential to gain is still greater than the loss. If we churches are, you know, fresh expressions and other ways, agencies are trying to become more integrative of understanding the postmodern generation, there's a real chance. You know, it's not like it's all doomed. You know, our mission agencies who are 100 years old just need to close down. This is not the message, you know. But as if much as we can integrate the young ones into our and help them to walk the journey. That's probably my biggest outcome for today. I just think if we can walk the journey with these young ones from faith to indicating a mission interest to coaching them through to actually end up somewhere, this is going to have the highest success rate across Europe. And I just mentioned that some of the challenges we face is not just the unemployment, but also, of course, the masses or not masses of Christians we have across Europe, our continent. You know, we have 740 million Europeans and about 20 million evangelicals. So that is already very hard. You know, I've just, you know, been to Montenegro. You have the one youth leader there in the whole of the country. So what does it do, you know, to the next generation? Or also I had Polish leaders, youth leaders, cry on me because so many of the Polish pastors had left, you know, for the green grass somewhere else. What does it say to a young generation that it's not worth investing into you? Or, you know, they have these big questions. And interesting then, on the other side, when I do my mission at conferences and, you know, we have about 3,000 from 50 European nations. I mean, there are 47 plus the STAN countries we include. The number one question I get in the counseling areas, can God use me? It's the number one question. Though they come, you know, mostly from somewhat pampered households, it's about them. It's about how many instruments we can get them to play, how many sports they can do during the week. You know, parents do a lot around children today, drive them everywhere, every day. You know, but they still have this insecurity because they don't know that God loves them ultimately. They have this big insecurity thing, you know, am I really good enough? And we have that question more than ever. I mean, if you compare that to other generations, these young ones struggle with their identity because they don't know what are their giftings. And some of the churches I've been to in Europe, you're only someone if you're 40. But I mean, I went on my first outreach when I was 13, you know, with CEF and serving at the beach mission. But if we wait until they're 40, they're gone. They've left our churches. So we need to start very, very young. And some of the things we found out where we can help them is to actually, you know, help them to discover their identity. Who are they? You know, who are you? What is your identity? That we help them to read the Bible. So one of the things across Europe now, we try to erase Bible poverty. It's also by the World Evangelical Alliance, a strong motto, erase Bible poverty. Try and help our young ones again to bring the actual book, not just the app on your phone. Bring the book, and actually, we do try to do lots of inductive Bible studies. Now, looking just at the text with no commentaries, just exploring what does the Bible say to me. Help them to pray and discover their gifts and talents, and find out what are they good in. Where can they play their niche, and what do they like? Encourage them to ask for feedback. You know, give them the space actually to know what they're good in, and also what are really is beating for them. I try to find studies around, you know, young ones finding faith, and actually the Americans have I followed so many pages, but maybe Scott, you know where it's from. They say 80% of all people find their faith in Jesus by the age of 18, but I couldn't get to the source. Everyone uses this phrase, but there's no source. Now I found the first one in Northern Ireland from Summer Madness. I don't know if you've heard of this, a fantastic youth festival. They did their first analysis. So I said, please, in Europe, we need some more researchers who really do stuff around youth ministry. So if you are still considering a bachelor or master's, help us to do something regarding youth and so on. So they did an analysis, and it just came out in December, so it's very recent. And whatever I've got, I'm happy to share that with you. I'll send you the links to these various researches. But so they looked at, you know, what is that, the before you came to these camps and before you became a Christian, how was your church connection? So as you can see, you know, lots of them have been, you know, very strongly connected to church because of Christian parents and upbringing and so on. Some were somewhat involved and some not. So that was understandable. But then we asked them, how did you come to faith? How they came to faith, you know? And so they said, you know, which again, which shows the process. It's no longer that they can always pinpoint to a date and say, this is it. You know, it is for them, you know, something which happened, but I don't know when or how, gradual awakening, 20%, or can't remember a time without God. That, of course, is for the ones who are raised in Christian families. They don't know when the conversion really happened. Event or process, or, you know, 26% only having a definite conversion moment. And then we looked into the age, you know, when did faith become real for them? Because they, you know, do conferences and events and mission outreaches and so on. So you see that, you know, until 10 years is 30%, then 11 to 14 years, 26%, 15 to 17, 18%. So we can see, you know, 84% of all people become Christians before the age of 25. So really we need to, this is the crucial age where we need to challenge them and commit their lives. Otherwise it is so much harder to bring them back to faith. And we know once they've left church, some of them, you know, they found out in America that they, some of them will come back once they've got children themselves and they want to have a Christian education for them. They're going to come back to Bible school, to Sunday school and so on. But there's nothing in between. So in Germany, at least, we are losing the ones between 20 to 30, to 40 in our churches like crazy. It's the missing gap. And just the last, actually last two on this one. You know, what made the difference for them that faith became real? When we look at the age groups there, you know, it's under 17 to the left, or 18 to 35, or plus 35. And you can see how church has become very influential, and then it comes less. You know, where friends have been less, and then they become more. So it just, I can't go into all these headings here, but I thought it was fascinating for them, or for us, to work. You know, what is it, the relationships, influence of other Christians, 13%. School, well, it wasn't that important. But then, you know, when you get older, in the 18 to 35, you realize that it's all about, you know, 44% about relationships within the church. If you haven't got any friends at church, you are most likely not to go and attend the services. Does it make sense to you? Do you see that also across your churches? So I'm just praising God that someone started in Northern Ireland, and I wish we would do that analysis even more in our various countries. And just going to go on for the next slide. So that's my last one here. Who made the difference? Who made the difference? So it's family members, friends or colleagues of the category, the minister, or here's the priest. You know, you can see very, very little between the under 17, you know, and then not easy to identify, that's fine. And then youth workers. And the youth workers actually, you know, are very strong. We know that, you know, in youth ministry, when they're in that age, they're not interested in what their parents say, they're interested in what the youth leader says. Very much. He is the dominating factor in the lives of a young person. So we better make sure that we choose our youth workers very wisely. And we have, of course, the big problem today that our youth workers only last 2 years in ministry. That's an average statistic we have across Europe. So how can we... 2 years. Yeah, it's either because they're just, you know, they're the youngest or the oldest person on the youth group team, so that they're just asked to become youth leaders then, which is always a bit of a nuisance. They have no one to mentor them. That's one of the things they really struggle with, so they just leave, they feel burned out, or they just move on because they study, you know, somewhere else and engage and so on. But I heard a statistic from America that's even 14 months only in America. That, of course, relates to the non-paid youth workers, which is mainly what we have in Europe. There's only the Netherlands and Germany and Switzerland and others who are actually able to pay a youth worker, and the rest of Europe is hardly happening. So now I'm going to that, you know, taking from the youth and where they're at and what conversion, you know, means to them and how they get there to a missional mindset, because this is why we're here. We want to explore, you know, what does it mean, you know, to develop a missional mindset? How can we get the local and the global into them? You know, we just don't want to just concentrate on, you know, having a great church, but we want them to think globally, to act globally, to be part of, you know, we say, you know, act local, but think global, you know, trying to be engaging them on various levels. And we realized, and that's also now part of my dissertation, that you have to start local. I mean, you will never get anyone fantastic out there if you have not done, you know, the homework right on the forefront of your church and if you, on your youth group. So living in fellowship again, so trying to bring, to provide this family unit, and of course serving anywhere, everywhere to everywhere. So I've looked at events, and I tried to analyze Urbana and Zima in Latin America. There's Mission Korea in Korea, obviously, and other nations. I tried to see, has anyone done any impact analysis of conferences? And I mean, Urbana runs for 60 years already, but sadly, no one has kept any statistics or anything for the last years, so they can refer back to. But I was interested to hear, you know, we asked the young ones to fill in decision cards, but we don't know, we don't follow up. You know, have they actually been, you know, going on a short-term outreach, or have they gone long-term somewhere, as they had indicated? But so I thought, okay, I'm just going to start with MissionEd. I have had 4 conferences now since 2009, and so I've come back to the ones who started. So I've analyzed who has come twice to the MissionEd conferences, so I could at least try and catch a bit of a change, if there is any. So I looked at cognitive changes. Has anything regarding cognitive change towards missions changed? I looked into behavior. You know, do they study the Bible more? Do they read more? Do they give more to missions? Also, do they go on short-term outreaches and engage in the local communities, become active in social, you know, justice programs or whatsoever? And some of the stuff I found, I'm just giving you here just as a quick thing. I mean, if you're ever interested to read more in this, you're happy and invited to read my dissertation, which is, praise God, not too bad. And I wrote it in 3 weeks, so I shouldn't tell that to anyone. But I had a great team. My professor said he's never seen such a teamwork around a dissertation. And these were all young people who've gone through MissionEd. I think they paid the benefits to me, you know, having seen a transformation in their own lives. But so people just said, you know, I did this missionary journey, which we had at the conference, and it's like the only purpose of my life. It's like if my life starts here. I didn't really serve. Didn't want to serve the Lord while waiting to go into the world. Actually, I just misquoted something here. They came back. Actually, this is statements from people who have actually understood what a mission lifestyle is, and then said, "I'm going to implement that into my journey." I'm just going to show you in a minute the change which has happened, or it's the privilege of living a mission lifestyle. So they understand. Having come, so I've analyzed, you know, they come before, I checked their cognitive understanding of missions before and then after, and then also a year or 2 years after. So some of the stuff, for example, which we did, which looks probably terrible to you, but these were my analysis from the various surveys I did as I was interviewing people who came to MissionEd, and then also looking into how much this has changed, you know, and then I realized actually through attending regular mission events, of course, you know that the view of missions changes. You know, it changes cognitively in small steps. But the more you attended something on missions, the more your heart was changed. And also we realized that with the younger ones, the younger ones just came for the fun. You know, and we realized there are 5 different types of people who come to your mission events. Some just come for the program and want to just see the band and the speakers. They get the least out of a youth mission conference. But the ones who are hungry and say, "I just want to hear from God about my calling," they're the ones who love it the most, and they hear God speaking. It's fascinating, you know, how people react to various things. And I think, please don't come for the program. I'm not getting the top speakers. But then, you know, this is what they get. So they're saying, you know, views on missions change. There's here one example. I don't want to go to Africa. I felt if I give God one finger, he will take my whole hand. Mission had changed my life. I realized I can be a Christian, not be a missionary. God can use me wherever I am and also where I like to be. She came to the first Congress in 2009, Sarah from Switzerland, and said, I've just hardly, you know, renewed my commitment to God. Her parents, grandparents were missionaries to Africa, and they set an awful example to her. So she knew that was never what she wanted to be. and then seeing the realization of, and then she became part of the team and later become part of the translators, and then now she's serving in Tunisia, and she just texted me, you know, that her language helper just became a Christian, and she's been to her baptism. You know, so we see that there are steps going, but it takes time. And so then also, you know, view and mission, that's again the cognitive thing here. And also then we looked at, you know, can it, you know, encourage participants to actually get mission practice. So we challenged them to go out and try to engage with your local mission agencies in your countries and see what is out there, what can you do. So we've realized that actually it has affected their jobs, that they're much more active in their jobs to be a Christian. That would be something which was pleasing to Steiner, you know, living missions at your work. They've started to read the Bible more. They've given more money to missions. So we really see there's a gradual change in there. And one of the things I was really excited about, which makes maybe no sense here for you, but I asked them, you know, has your involvement changed even within, you know, mission? So some of these guys have come back to 4 conferences, and they started off as coming as a participant, like I was when I was 15. And then later on, they thought, I liked it so much, I come back, and then they start to become volunteers. And then God speaks to them again, they go on a short-term outreach. And then next time they come back, they actually come and say, I'm going to be part of the core team organizing the conference. And then the next step is that at the 4th conference, now we had few of these ones I interviewed, actually now are missionaries serving, and they just came back from the field to be part of the exhibition, say, it changed my life, I want to now give something back to MissionNet. So this is what I think we all are dreaming to see in our work, that we actually journey with people until they've got there. And so I think we need to find elements in our ministries that we make sure that what are the intervals, what are the things in between we offer for them to come. And so, you know, what helps them to go and last in their commitment? So I analyzed that. I asked the youth leaders on their discipleship, missional discipleship, if they had implemented what they'd learned. I've asked the Evangelical Alliance leaders across Europe to say, you know, comment on what have you received through mission and have you seen any differences? And people responded like this, and I think I found it absolutely thrilling and very significant. They say, people say they're lost in the missionary journey and get there if they have friends and people, of course, who support them. Actually, we have seen lots of pastors come with their young ones to an event, or actually pastors invest into their young ones. It has a huge effect on them, a huge effect. Friends who are similar than I am, on fire, who are mission-minded. But you can forget about the missionary congress here, but it's the same now applying to others. That you have a mentor, someone I'm accountable to. This is the cry of the young generation, someone I can be accountable to. And I realized even here I'm mentoring every mealtime someone younger across Europe. They had booked me for slots. And every single one of them said, I wish I would have a mentor back home. I wish I would have someone who would journey with me. And I've seen so many tears this week, and I'm so burdened that we actually do not put it so much into practice for them. Then for their spiritual life, you know, they need someone to pray and read the Bible with. And we know that, you know, even our pastors sometimes have a hard time opening the Bible. We just see them on their iPad or whatever, scrolling through. We don't see the actual book anymore opened in our churches. So how can we foster this? How can we really bring the Bible back, that actually people see us open the Bible? Don't know about you, but sometimes, it's a choice I have to make each time I'm with a young person to consciously open the Bible. I had a great Norwegian role model, Ole Magnus, always does it, always. And I think this is what we need to do, encourage them and those in their discipleship. And then the next stage for them to take on, of course, are the outreaches. I mean, we can debate about them if they're good or bad. You know, some are not having great impact, but we need them. 100% of everyone who has come into long-term service has done a short-term outreach. I mean, maybe you find one or two in between the 1,000 who's gone straight. But in general, it is taking the small steps. So what we have, you know, in our survey now here, what are we doing with the young ones and through organizations? We say you need to remind the young people about the decisions they've made at the conferences. You need to remind them. You need to, you know, challenge them. What have you done about it? And when we've got the contact details, we need people to follow up on national levels. We need to start quickly. And also we need to really teach them a discipline as well as us. So what I've seen, and that's finishing that part here, It really is, it's a process and it's taking small steps. If you think you're going to recruit quickly the young generation that, and then you're in for big trouble. So I know that we go somewhere and we have this big expectation. I come back home and I have recruited, you know, 50 more applicants for my agency because that's good for the finance guy back home, that it was worth, you know, investing into something, but actually it is taking lots and lots of small steps. Any questions on that before I go to the next topic on discipleship? Okay. This is now my what I'm most passionate about, because I think we're just losing it completely. I'm just going to try and do that with the chairs here. So in discipleship, and if you've been with Dave Petty or the Navigators, or I mean that's the Joy Adventure or Exodus, or there is Lef in the Netherlands, and there is in Sheffield the 3DM. These are like the top five organizations across Europe who are trying to work on youth discipleship and bring them into missions. How many of you have done the Lean study or have read the Lean study by Willow Creek? A Reveal study is called. Reveal study. And I find it fascinating because they analyze their church members, how do they grow in faith? And they realize that there are different steps, and which I find very similar to the steps we are now practicing and role modeling around mission agencies across Europe now in our youth ministries. So we have these four steps. And so sometimes, you know, we actually now, what I've seen happening, I find it fascinating, and I'm just going to sit down through these chairs here. We bring young people into our context who are not Christians because we want to win them. You know, I mean, we just don't want to just build on the ones who are there, but we want to win. We want to win young people to Christ because we want to have them, you know, a calling. I mean, this is our passion. We want to see nations being transformed. We want Europe to be met by God. So we win them, and we do lots of stuff in our churches to win them. And then we build. And I wonder which step you are the strongest. So I'm going to ask you that in a minute. We build, we do lots of Bible studies for them, prayer studies, and whatever. You know, teaching, Sunday services, lots of frontal teaching. And we build and build and build and build and build. And this is where Willow Creek found out in their study that if you do not do more than that, people just become very, is it lethargic? You know, you just reach a certain plateau. There's no missions on it. You just become a good Christian. You donate some good money, but this is it. But we want to see missions as the outcome, right? So we have to go and say, okay, I'm going to send you. And the only ones where we see a difference among the young ones is if we send them somewhere, if they're involved in any church mission activity or any social project run by the church or by the mission agencies. And this is where we have the biggest dilemma between these two chairs here from win and build, but we don't do anything to multiply, you know. It's not multiply, it's win, equip, you know. We give them tasks and then we just let them go on their own. And then they crash, you know, on a mission trip or whatsoever, and they think this is it, you know. I'm not called, just because we give them something, but then we don't entrust them more. So I think if we are not engaging our young ones in activities, they will not stay in church. That's also what came out of the study. But they will also not go into further steps. So I'm very burdened by that. And then, of course, we want them not only to become disciples, but we want them to become disciple makers. We want them to you know, you have been reached by the love of God. And so now is your turn to bring the love of God somewhere. And our mission agencies and churches, you know, we stumble around the first two somehow. You know, some of us are great in evangelism, but then we don't do anything with follow-up sometimes. But then we hardly do anything for that equip period here for the young ones and say, you know, I'm going to, you know, entrust you that you can be a good leader. And Exodus and Northern Ireland has now been sought after by so many mission agencies because they see 700 young watch each summer go through a discipleship program, and it can be one of these four, and then you go with your team on a missions outreach, and you're going to be discipled before and after with such a high success rate of them then turning into missionaries, so that all these agencies now, mission agencies, have said, you know, what is the secret? How can we do it? Because often, I know that I just collect a team of young people, I take them with me to, I don't know, I was just really recently at the harbor in Athens among the refugees, You know, if I just drop them and just do something great, and then 5 days after we all go back to our own homes, there is no discipleship, you know, element in there. Nothing will stay as a lasting, I mean, a nice, great memory because we have changed the world for some refugees, you know. But so what? I mean, we've done nothing more than just smiling and maybe giving a Bible and some sweets and sleeping bags. But this is not creating, you know, disciple makers. So I would like you to turn in your groups and say, you know, where do you think that with my organization, with my church, where am I focusing on the most? And is there any desire to actually to overstep that or overcome or, you know, seek someone expertise on that and, you know, say what is out there? I do believe that there are no reasons, there are no tools which are just the only tools which work. I think what we see from our studies is that you need to have church and missions relating to each other. You need youth church and youth groups relate to mission agencies. It has to go hand in hand, and it's a process of a long time. And also, it's the question to ask: are we willing to invest into a long time, person, a long time relationship with someone, you know, eager? You know, young people today, they apply to various mission agencies at the same time. You know, and they want to say, see, how good are you? How are you looking after me? How are you treating my questions and so on? There's no longer that I'm caught just to this one single agency. You know, it's more like, where do I feel good? Where is someone there looking after me? So how are we in this, you know, society trying to engage with the young ones and say, I'm opening doors for you and I'm willing also to go the extra miles. I have hundreds of young ones who just approach me and say, you know, can you just pray for me? I'm taking this step and this, you know, are we willing to open our hearts to them and say, it does not matter if you're going to come my, you know, join my mission agencies, but it is that I'm investing into you to take your next steps towards missions, and I will do anything I can do to help you to get there. So I'm finishing off with that. What I've done, inspired by these mission agencies, especially on youth mission discipleship, I have looked at all my core team members on my team and said, you know, where are you in these stages? You know, what can I do to help you to take the next step? So actually, I've talked with them through that and said, you know, I think you're in this building thing, but I want you to overcome and get more experience, get hands-on. I want you to stay in the game for long. And so then, you know, we come up with some ideas and plans, and now these young ones who lead teams, you know, worldwide, it's the young ones who are out there taking on responsibility. So I just only encourage us to really invest into them and believe in them and pamper them when they need to, and also kick them in the butt when they need it. You know, it's working both ways for them.